From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Urban green spaces mean more to communities than just aesthetics or places to go for a run. Research connects obesity and some mental health disorders to the lack of open space, health risks which can be more prevalent in urban areas where there are few places to be active. Joining me to talk about the impacts of parks on mental and physical health are two research associates from the Georgia Health Policy Center. Jimmy Dills and Michelle Rushing are with me. Hello.
Good morning.
Morning. Thanks for having us.
Well, thanks for being here. Also speaking with us today is Venice Jennings. She's a biological scientist at the U.S. Forest Service in Athens. Hello, Venice.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, thanks so much for coming. And I really want you to explain biological scientist. What do you do exactly?
Thank you. My title is biological science, and that's based on my coursework, but I'm a general research scientist with the USDA Forest Service.
So you look at how people interact with forests?
Oh, it can be a number of things across the gambit. For example, a big part of the intention of my research has been to assess what we've been learning on this topic through the years so that we can strategically talk with one another and provide a holistic approach to considering how green spaces can impact different dimensions of health and well-being.
So what are the things that you've discovered top line about that interaction?
Oh, a number of things. For example, there was a project that I was involved in that was published in 2016, where we looked at public parks across different cities in the U.S. and different aspects of well-being, particularly as those described by Gallup's Well-Being Index. And we found that cities with a larger coverage of public parks had overall higher levels of overall well-being, but also that was particularly driven by social and community as well as physical well-being.
Ah, so social and community. We've heard a lot about, you know, obesity. Mm-hmm. People mm-hmm. get out in the parks, mm-hmm. they walk in the parks, and also the sort of psychic space. But the social interaction, that's interesting. What can you tell us about that?
It is. Our health is influenced by the context of place. There's a lot of discussion in the academic space about place-based health promotion, and these spaces can encourage people to get out, interact with others, whether that can be around particular gardening activities, sports. So this can improve or at least influence how we perceive our spaces and the people who live in them.
Well, let's look at this. Michelle and Jimmy, you've both done a lot of research on this. How urban spaces relate to health? Can you give us some sense of where the research is now?
Sure. There are a lot of studies that have been done. And so what we really do is we try to kind of aggregate all of those into a bigger picture of guidance, taking a lot of studies that have been done in very specific ways and just finding there are a lot of indirect benefits that can help the entire community from parks where it simply contributes to better air quality and also kind of reducing the heat buildup in the community. And then there are also more immediate effects that can be achieved whether you use the park or not in terms of people just seeing green space, being exposed to green space. We find that there are lower rates of stress, lower rates of depression, lower rates of violent behavior, better school performance for children. And of course, those are higher if you do use the park, but they really also benefit the whole community. And then also kind of moving down the chain for people who are using the parks. We really see a lot of physical activity benefits. It's really a great space. It doesn't necessarily mean that if you live next to a park, you're automatically going to become more active. But for somebody who wants to be active, having that park available is really going to increase the opportunity and their chance of being active.
Well, use is something we definitely want to get to. But Jimmy, I want to get to you. The Georgia Health Policy Center, where you work, have co-facilitated a number of projects around Metro Atlanta, like the Atlanta Beltline. What kind of initiatives are taking place on the Beltline?
That's actually not what I do, but I know we've been working on that. Michelle can certainly speak more to it as she's more involved with that type of work. But I know there's a lot of work being done to get people out on the trail, using it safely, thinking about how it connects to the communities that it's in already and how that's going to grow in the places where it's continuing to be built out. And so it really is the idea of that common thread that runs through the community and really knits together different neighborhoods rather than creating barriers between them, which is what traditional transportation infrastructure would do in terms of large roads, but having park space be that connective tissue really sets the context for all these behaviors and positive health outcomes that we're talking about here.
So what do you do? Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I don't know if you have time. Really, we work a lot in the space that Venice really set up clearly of place-based health. And so we know that it's really important to have access to care and medical care. All those, the traditional health model is important. But over the last several decades, public health has started to really understand that you need to work on the context for behaviors and the environments where socialization happens, where people potentially have the chance to walk regularly, to get to a park, to then meet with neighbors and participate in a festival or whatever the thing is going on there. But public health as a profession is really starting to think more about how can we strategically integrate into those policy-making, decision-making spheres in a constructive way and not just coming in from a regulatory, you know, you have to get your environmental contaminants down to this level,
right.
But really thinking about
right.
how do you create a supportive environment.
And behaviors and urban planning and infrastructure, all of those things are involved. Michelle, you having done this research, did you want to pick up on that?
Yeah, so the Beltline is a great example. We actually did a health impact assessment before it was even developed, which really provided some guidelines. So they were able to analyze park acreage per person all the way around the city and find that some quadrants were more underparked, as we call it, than others. But also the city of Atlanta in general has fewer park acres per person than many other cities do. And that's really one of those things that we find is generally going to influence the health of the entire community. I mean, we think about the U.S. as being, you know, we spend a lot on healthcare, but we don't get great value for our dollar. People are not necessarily living their longest potential lives or having the best potential health and being healthy every day because we don't have really healthy places to live. So we were using health impact assessment in that case. That was many years ago at this point. To really predict how the Beltline could be built out in order to maximize development so that it would make healthy places for people to live. And, of course, the big issue is making sure that those opportunities are distributed all the way around through all of our communities. We have many different communities, so making sure that the parks are developed across the city and also that people have access to all of the different areas and all of the different amenities that are developed. More recently, some things have been done. So, for example, the West Side Trail has been developed, and we've seen some opportunities. For example, with Kaiser Permanente of Georgia has partnered with the Beltline to actually put out some programs that will encourage people to use it, some walking groups, some bicycling activities, farm stands, play days, things like that.
Well, so I'm sure that becomes a selling point for the Beltline when they're presenting it to, you know, get funding. They say these are some of the benefits. How much do you think that actually, and Venice, maybe you can answer this, how much do you think that actually figures into the thinking of how cities, towns, places are developed?
Well, that can have different layers. For example, I was recently involved with a publication where we looked at inequitable access to green spaces and how that relates to issues around environmental justice, but also in the public health space, that can lead to the development of health disparities being major gaps in health. And that article looked at it from the context of outcomes such as cardiovascular diseases, obesity, psychological wellness, as well as heat-related illnesses. So it's something to consider, but again, there's also other social factors at play that can influence how these spaces are received by different communities.
That's Venice Jennings. She's a biological scientist at the U.S. Forestry Service in Athens. Also with me, we have Jimmy and Michelle, who are from the Georgia Health Policy Center. I was getting
you got
that
it.
Right. Good. Well, I want to pick up on that, what Michelle said about being underparked. And I think that's what your research has involved in a great way, Venice. What does that mean? What ideally, how much access or how far away from parks would people be? Do we know it to that? Can we draw a bead on that?
It can vary, quite honestly. For example, there have been different metrics for with the CDC. Was it the half mile, the residential distance, for example, within a half mile distance of a park? Throughout the years, studies have looked at it from the sense of proximity, but also overall coverage, because we're a moving population. And so the access or use or exposure to these spaces can really vary.
So, and how about in terms of access? Is it in walkability? Is it in public transportation? How does that all figure
out? A lot of the language is framed in the sense of a half mile. radius.
Right. Mm-hmm. And how many people in Georgia have access with that kind of proximity?
Oh, overall, that's a good question. I have to get back to you on that one.
Well, Jimmy, this is part of what you do, that kind of, you look at the infrastructure. How, what are the barriers, how people get there? There's programming, of course, like Michelle was talking about, but how about the actual infrastructure that gets people to parks?
Yeah, I think that goes back to what your earlier guests were talking about, of thinking about, I jotted it down, elevating the whole, and mm-hmm. thinking about whole communities and that whole system in which people live, work, play, worship, work, all those things. And with the half-mile radius, that a lot of research showed, you know, yes, that's a quick measure of accessibility proximity, but that's not all there is. You've got to mm-hmm. have things in the park that the local community, if it's a neighborhood park, that the local neighbors actually want to use and go to. And then if you're creating safe street and transportation networks that you can walk to, so if you're increasing that walkability on the way to the park, some of the research I've been involved with years ago now has, in DeKalb County specifically, showed that people were 20% more likely to walk to the park if they're potential route to that park was more walkable. And we measured that and were able to put it in a model and be able to show that. And public health knows that parks are really a key venue for physical activity mm-hmm. and the social interactions that happen that make a strong community.
And that walkability is not just proximity, correct? I mean, right. It's like actually some places sidewalks just run out.
Yes.
And they're not particularly good sidewalks or yep. places to cross.
Exactly. And we found that the highest factor, at least in that one study that contributed to walkability, was the traffic. Mm-hmm. And so even though it was a walking study and you're studying a walking behavior, it was how busy was that road that you were walking alongside of. Even if there was a sidewalk there or not, it was more important that the potential pedestrian feel safer in that space and that it was a pleasant walk. And we differentiate between utilitarian and recreational physical activity. And so walking to the park is kind of utilitarian in the sense that you're using walking as transportation to get somewhere. Then in the park, your physical activity is recreation because you're playing in a softball league or whatever it might be. And the types of walking environments that spur those trips are slightly different. If you're walking to work every day on a commute, you want to probably the most direct route you can take. If you're walking to the park and it's a leisure walk, you might go a little bit out of your way to actually take a nicer route that's more pleasing to you aesthetically or feels safer because you're trying to integrate it into that sort of leisure trip rather than a work-related trip.
How about the safety once in the park? This is something that has varied and varies in different parks around the city, around the state, around the country.
Yeah, there are a lot of considerations about what actually makes a quality park. And of course, you can read for hours and hours about all of the ways that they measure those elements. It's definitely not just a matter of whether the park is physically there, but there are a lot of aspects in terms of how well it's maintained. You know, is the city doing a good job of maintaining it? Does it have a foundation, a Friends of the Park that is also helping with that maintenance? Are the neighbors involved? Do they call in when there's a problem with the park and try to get it fixed? So those things really contribute to perceptions of safety, and the perception of safety is a very important factor in whether people are using the park. And then coincidentally, whether people are using the park also helps make it safer because you have that sort of strength in numbers. When a lot of people are present, you're less likely to have an issue than potentially if you feel like you are very isolated. And so that's an important factor. And then there are other factors that really can be important as well to safety, you know, just whether it really has the amenities and the design that is appropriate to the community and the intended users. So you can have a park also that just doesn't have amenities that attract people there. And so that will also affect the usage and the perception of the park and the perception of safety.
So you and Jimmy were researchers behind this health impact assessment for low-income housing credits. So this is focusing on creating policy to connected low-income housing with surrounding communities. Now, what did your research find about low-income areas and access to parks in particular?
We haven't actually measured the distribution of parks kind of statewide, but one thing that is great about our statewide policy is that you can use the presence of a park in order to kind of increase the points you're scoring towards your likelihood of getting the tax credit. So that's helping make sure that we do have a supply of affordable housing for lower-income households that do have access to parks. And then they're also really innovating with some interesting things now. For example, We had done some work with the State Health Department to look at some of the amenities that can be created on site. They have to have amenities, but it's a little bit general about what they can actually choose, the developer can choose to build on site. So it turned out that one of the things they had a lot of opportunities to build were community gardens. And developers were really interested in that. It's apparently a very popular amenity for many of the people who are looking to move into affordable housing. And it was relatively kind of easy for them to build. And it's also something that they can operate well, and they know it promotes the health of their residents, which is important. So that kind of became part of those actual scoring criteria, that they can build a community garden and get extra points. And actually work that up into part of their scoring.
So, of course, the idea of parks, beautiful. In all artistic renderings of projects and plans, it's always a park, and it looks beautiful, and people love to use it. Of course, we're all supporting that kind of idea. But we've got just a minute left, so, Vernice, I want to put this to you. With all of the development that's going on, and pressure on land and competition, the idea of parks may be great. How do you sell it in terms of policy?
Well, I can't necessarily directly speak to the policy piece, but I will speak to a recent commentary that I was involved with where it talked about urban green spaces and the pursuit of health equity being the opportunity for all of us to have an equal opportunity at achieving optimal health. And that comes from the standpoint of connecting these spaces to larger issues in the community. How does it interact with youth engagement, job creation, and revitalization? But there's also the piece of concern around gentrification that has come up in a number of low-income areas, in the sense of this space is revitalized, but also, can I stay?
Well, Vernice, I want you to stick around. Thank you so much. Vernice Jennings is a biological scientist at the U.S. Forest Service in Athens. Jimmy Dills and Michelle Rushing, both research associates for the Georgia Health Policy Center. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Stick around. There's a lot more coming up on Second Thought.